Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you, Leo Brown. Almost hour. Culture, current events, our Catholic faith, all of that happening. 50 minutes every afternoon. Lori Desitel is with us this afternoon of Revelations in Education. We'll be talking to her. Interesting article, I posted it over on my Facebook page a few days ago. This talking about students who slip through the cracks and then the hope of being able to keep them from slipping through the cracks, but unfortunately, maybe not the best methods, at least in my opinion. We'll talk to Lori, who knows a whole lot more about this stuff than me, and she will discuss this with us, but we'll get into that. Also, I put this on my Facebook page, found it earlier from Newsweek. Apparently, what Newsweek seems to be asking, has the Catholic Church jumped the shark? Right. Is it over as far as the relevancy of the Catholic Church is concerned? Seems to be what they're asking, which not sure that we need Newsweek to ask this question. We should be asking this as Catholics and see what we could do. But we'll get into that, talk a little bit about that later on as well. All of that and more after this. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back in a moment.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Culture, current events, our Catholic faith once a month, joined by Lori Desitel's Revelations in Education. Lori, how are you?
I'm great, Leo. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being with us.
I am thrilled to be back today. Thank you.
And back because you also went to Dubai since the last time we talked, right?
Yes, I did. I did. It feels so surreal now. But yeah, that was a great experience. And I'll have to share that at some point. Lots of learning with, looking at their educational system and similarities and differences. It was wonderful.
Well, that's great. Maybe we can talk about that today as well. But I wanted to get into this article because I had a little bit of conversation about this over on my Facebook page. And then you reposted it as well. And on the surface, this looks good. But my question is it really doing what we need to do? Or is this just an additional disservice? Because essentially, it's from the New York Times talking about Hispanic and African-American students that kind of slip through the cracks. Generally, I would guess primarily because their parents are not as involved. I think it's kind of what the focus of this is. Yet, they've decided that they're going to use what I would consider archaic and perhaps even dangerous tools of the standard IQ test to try to identify these kids. And to me, it looks like that's just creating another problem. What do you think?
Right. No, I agree. And, I reread this article, when we talked earlier this morning, and it's a huge challenge for all of us because the racial disparities, Leo, not only in IQ testing, but in the number of school suspensions and expulsions, and looking at the differences from the National Fair Test Organization reports huge discrepancies in SAT scores. And I don't know what the solution is, but it's very, very important to talk about it because there are definitive racial disparities, and we are excluding minority groups who are highly intelligent and creative and innovative because of lack of a better word. And I have to be careful when I speak because I don't want to generalize at all, but there is a bias to these tests,
exactly.
A cultural bias to these tests that we're giving in public schools.
Yeah, and the test, if we dig back far enough, and this was a surprise to me reading Sir Kenneth Robinson's material, that really it was a tool designed to weed out certain individuals, and it was one that would only really anyone that excelled at this, it was designed for those particular individuals to excel and for others not to. And why we're still using this, I don't understand.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't understand that either. And again, it's, you know, it's researchers are all over this. And I wanted to point out, too, I was doing a little research this morning, and I want to, you know, state, too, that there are many high poverty and high minority schools that are producing high achieving students. So, again, that is not the norm, but we know that, you know, intellectual functioning, the way we test it, has a definitive bias. And so, you know, a question that I don't know if we can create that type of test, but, you know, I think it's impossible to create a culture-free test, but can we create a culturally fair test? Because culture is really not in a social category. It's an experience. You know, when you look at a person's culture, it's their collection of experiences. And Leo, I don't know if we can test that. And here's something else too. Our youngest daughter is getting ready to go to college in the fall. And she is on that leading edge of where many universities are not using the SAT scores as they were 6-7 years ago when our oldest son went to college. And many of the universities that are not relying on these SAT scores are seeing a much more deeply diverse collegiate population. And I love that because I think that, again, this is my humble, very subjective opinion, but I see intelligence in so many areas. I align myself with Howard Gardner's work out of Harvard.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's really something how we still look at a singular fill in the box, you know, score to mark someone's intellect and capacity. So that, I think it's changing. I think we're awake to how insufficient it is, but there's a lot of work to be done in that area. A lot of work.
Lori Desitel is with us this afternoon. Revelations in Education is her website, Edutopia, where she writes as well. And we're talking about this again, which I think on the surface, it's like, great, right? This, they're paying attention to this. They're giving these kids opportunity, but they're using a tool that that really should not be used. And it's if we could ever find a way that says, okay, and I don't know, Lori, is there anything that's even attempted to test, what is it, the seven intelligences that Gardner recognizes?
Yeah, and if there is, I'm not aware of it. But what you said, something that just struck me. I mean, I just felt my heart race for a second. And I think that we, again, as a global world, Western culture and Eastern culture have very different experiences, but I think we're going to have to stop relying on one metric, one instrument, because intelligence is vast and it's deep. And Howard Gardner, and many have, you know, argued this, but Howard Gardner has actually discovered and explored specific brain areas for different intelligence. And when I think about our genius children who do live in some poverty or who are going to school with adverse conditions, oh my gosh, Leah, we cannot afford not to look at how that affects their ability to do school, meaning to problem solve, to emotionally regulate, to, you know, look at choices, to think, sequentially. We've got to find a variety of assessment tools, brain-aligned assessment tools to determine not intelligence, but a child's strength and expertise and passion. That is where, and so after break, I have to share this kind of epiphany that happened today. And again, very, very serendipitous to our talk this afternoon. But I think we've got to not be so absolute and definitive in looking at one instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you would think with this understanding, which obviously, I mean, it's not in the collective conscience necessarily, unless you study the stuff and you realize where these tools came from. But still, you would think with this day and age, with an understanding that there is such a spectrum, that there's no three or four elements that you could say, this is how we measure intelligence. This is what makes someone superior to someone else. I mean, you would think by now we would say, wait a minute. This is not the metric that we need to be considering with the multitude of talents and gifts that are out there. And again, I was so moved, and it's been years since I read the book, The Element, but this is what Robinson talks about. There is no bell curve if we understand what intelligence really looks like. And I just can't believe that we're applauding archaic methods is really what it looks like.
Right. And I think, you know, again, not because I love the brain so much, but I do feel that the questions that you're posing this afternoon with regard to how we assess intelligence are in definitive alignment with how we are learning that, for instance, memory in the brain happens all over the brain. Emotions in the brain are not designated to one area, just as intelligence cannot be assessed by one instrument. So I think with the growing research in neuroscience applied to leadership, applied to education, I think we're moving. It's a slow process, but I think we are moving in seeing, you know, what are we thinking as far as what is intelligence, and then look, Leo, at Dan Goleman's work in emotional intelligence, and the research behind the emotional intelligence piece is saying that really companies are looking for what also Daniel Pink describes as that new conceptual intelligence, you know, being able to make meaning out of situations and to play and to think creatively and innovatively. So there's a lot happening in this arena, and it's exciting, but it's slow.
Yeah. Slow and hasn't dominated, right?
Absolutely.
We still got the dominant tools, unfortunately, that have been out there forever, which are pretty dull tools.
they are. And but I wanted to share, and we probably have to go to break, so I don't know how many minutes we have left. I'm waiting for that music to
That's right. We got time. You can start and we can pick up on the other side. Not a problem.
Okay. So I wrote to you this morning, I'm constantly learning, but to move any of us, meaning to intrinsically motivate any of us. And this is what, you know, when we talk about intellectual assessment and intelligence, it really is based, Leo, on two facets of human functioning or human capacity. And you and I have talked extensively about emotional connection. And I saw it in the article that you shared with me. The students that were placed in these high achieving gaps also had teachers that were aligned with where these students were performing. Mm. So there was this growth mindset in this classroom where expectations were higher. And there was, a connection of how students were feeling and how teachers were perceiving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which again comes right back to all the stuff you talk about. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Lori Desitels is with us this afternoon. More to come. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour, back after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, Almost Hour, Culture, Current Events, Our Catholic Faith. We talk about that for 50 minutes every afternoon here. Lori Desitels joins us monthly from Edutopia and Revelations in Education. Welcome back.
Thank you, Leo.
Before the break, we just kind of started to discuss a little bit more of what you see in this study where we were talking about, yeah, you're using IQ tests, but there's also something about the connection from the teachers to the students, which really can make all the difference. And that's kind of where your work lies, is this emotional connection that can come from that type of relationship. So pick it back up where you left that off.
So it was interesting. I today, right before, actually an hour ago, I got home and I was finishing up my time at a middle school, a very large, public, diverse middle school here in Indianapolis. And I'm working, I don't know, Leo, if I mentioned, I'm working with 10 of the most complex, genius, vulnerable sixth grade students in the building. And I asked for this group. And so today, I started with them in January and I finished today. And believe me, I'm going back to this testing piece here. And so what I discovered today in reflecting as I drove home and walking Nellie, our dog, I reflected that the success and the feeling felt, and I'm talking about academic success, only can happen in two movements. And this is what I started to talk about before break. I did not build healthy emotional connections with these 10 students because I was with them 45 minutes to an hour once a week. And they absolutely were triggered by abandonment with me. No one said goodbye to me today except for one young woman who interestingly enough, had worked with her last year. And we had built that connection. But these are students, 12 and 13 year olds, that have experienced significant adversity. And they are not being successful in the classroom. School success is not a part of their, total self, like looking at self-efficacy. And so I really, Leo, learned so much, and I learned from contrast and all this talk and research and, these interviews and presenting to these schools where I'm asked to go to all the time. What I learned today is that even with my area of knowledge in brain alignment and the strategies I employed with them, that it did not make difference. Words are not heard until there is a deepened emotional connection. And I was not able to form that in a short amount of time with those students.
Wow.
And again, no excuses, but I really, really, I'm going to be writing about this after we finish the show today. So back to the testing. I want to go through number two. So emotional connection is number one. And then the second piece of this that equals, so it's emotional connection plus islands of success equals purpose for students. And I think that's a formula that we just cannot forget as community members, with our youth, with as teachers, because when we can create the smallest islands or chunks of success in the classroom for our students, when we can help them to see from a different lens that something that they are good at, something that they are passionate about matters, we are putting them on that academic trajectory for success. And I want to share one thing that when I was observing a young woman at one of our lowest Indianapolis public school middle schools, Emma Donnan was the school several years ago. I was observing a new teacher and I saw a beautifully genius young woman take six pieces of food out of her backpack. It was like a smorgasbord of snacks. And she was very, very carefully unwrapping and eating each one without the teacher noticing. And Leo, it was masterful. It was creative. I watched in amazement. And I talked with this teacher afterwards, and I said, this, I know she broke the rules. I know this is not what you wanted during your instructional time, but this young woman is never experiencing success at school. How can we show her that what she just accomplished was masterful? And right. what could we do with her ability to, you know, take leadership in this way? So I want to say to parents and to teachers, and as we look at these testing scores, we cannot afford not to look at the multiple intelligence and the culture, which equates to experience of our diverse student population, because they're bringing in gifts, but we will never ever discover those, Leo, unless we make that emotional connection. And then we create the tiniest islands of success. I mean, it, whatever that is, if that's giving three vocabulary words or having a student come in and share something that they're good at, we've got to do that. And that's what we're mentoring teachers right now in our inner city schools in Indianapolis, and they're finding success with that.
Yeah, and I think it's, what a beautiful thing to say. That's a talent, right?
Oh my gosh, it was truly, and the shock on her face, you know, with this teacher, because I was not there. I would have loved to have shared it with the student myself, because I watched it, but I had a great connection with this new teacher. So we processed it and we sat down, and he was able to really share it in a way. He said her eyes were huge. So, I mean, it was very meaningful and very purposeful to her. And so I don't know how much of it, you know, how much changed for her in that classroom, but it changed the lens, at least for the time being.
Well, yeah, I think that those are the kind of things that we've got to really be able to start recognizing is how, and I know that that's what you do. That's the focus of your work. But again, I think I said this in one of the responses that I put out there to this story. It's not about, are you smart? How are you smart? Right?
That's exactly it. Oh, Leo, we need to do a whole show or a whole series on that, because you just said it. You just nailed it.
Yeah. Well, I've heard you say it, Lori. That's the reason why.
Well, but you remembered that. That's it. I mean, it is. It's how are you smart, not how smart are you.
So in all of this, you say things are slowly changing. You just went to Dubai. You had to get some sort of kind of global perspective, obviously, of where this is going. You're hopeful that we're changing this. You're hopeful that this is moving in the right direction. But how long is it going to take before we really do break these archaic cycles of just looking at certain things and then begin to see holistically the intelligence of a child?
Right. My middle daughter is in her, she's going to be a senior in college, and she's going into special education. And I said to Sarah the other day, I said, Sarah, I really feel that you are going to experience the shift. And so I don't think we're that far away. And being in Dubai was very interesting. In a word, their culture is different, obviously, but their desire for intrinsic motivation and engagement is as deep and as wanted as ours is in the United States. They're not dealing with a stressed poverty mind. They're dealing with a stressed mind of a student that is more maybe apathetic and is, you know, maybe just involved in so many activities. So engagement was a huge part of what they are desiring. And that's very, very similar, you know, to what we are wanting as educators and parents in the United States, or United States. And Leo, they're coming to Indianapolis in September. They're bringing a group of teachers, and the Ministry of Education is, they are going to be visiting the schools where we're implementing educational neuroscience. So that'll be, I'm really excited about that. And they're planning a trip over here to be a part of this work. So I'm very excited.
That's great. So there's obviously this movement is gaining steam. You think that in the time of whatever, from the time your daughter, before she actually steps into the job force, we're going to see a major shift.
I think we're going to see a major shift in how we use testing. And I think we're going to see a major shift in the sole metric of a test. I think that's where, I don't think it's going to go away, but I do think we're going to begin to see, you know, more assessments that encompass more of that multiple intelligence, that whole student. And I also think that we will see standardized testing is not sustainable, Leo.
No.
We can't, I mean, we've been doing this forever, and our scores and the morale, I mean, we still have a very unequal education in the United States right now.
Well, and it seems like it's everything. I don't care what it is. Everything seems to be kind of slanted toward memorization in large part, right? There's just
right.
a lot
Absolutely.
Of regurgitation and memorization when someone may be able to see something and explain it in their own way with complete and total detail. But if it's not necessarily memorized and a baloo is a bear, to wuzzle is to mix, which was our old kick.
Yeah.
You remember the comprehensive yeah. test of basic skills, right? But
yeah.
if you don't have that particular kind of lock of memory that just says, okay, I can get this stuff verbatim, the cards are stacked against you immediately. And that doesn't mean you're dumb.
No, absolutely. It does not. And I think more and more schools are really tapping into that, Leo.
All right, we're out of time, unfortunately, but this is yeah. great stuff to talk about. And Lori, we appreciate you being with us. Edutopia
thanks,
and
Leo.
Revelations in Education. We'll talk again soon. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Leo.
Back in a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Culture, current events, Catholic faith. That's what we talk about. 15 minutes every afternoon. I'm excited about this, and we'll see where it leads, but one of my favorite programs, and actually, I will still to this day pull up the recordings when I can find them, the videos that are out there, of old MTV Unplugged episodes, because it was so cool to see artists that would usually stretch into some sort of different world when they got into the acoustic mode, and to see some amazing performances on MTV. So MTV Unplugged coming back, and I'm excited about that. We'll see where that one leads. Information about that over at my Facebook page, Leo C. Brown. Got this from my Apple News portal, and I'm not sure what the original story, where it was, maybe the Blaze, if I'm not mistaken. Mother left in tears after being investigated for letting her kids play in the backyard. Yeah. So apparently the youngest is 2, the oldest is 8, I think, or 7, and 3 kids in a completely fenced-in backyard where she can keep an eye on them from the house, but let them play in the back, and the cops were called because her kids were unattended. That's a little bit crazy. Why we think we've got to get to that point? Look, I get protecting kids. I get that, and we want to do what we can, but there's a point at which it becomes intrusion. I know I've shared this story. I think I've shared this story before. You know, there was a time when it was back in the winter, snow on the ground, snow falling, actually, and it was one of those frustration points which happens with kids, and our oldest, who's 8, decides he's going to run away. Immediately at that point, right? And he's out the door before I can put boots on and a coat and a hat and you name it. He grabbed his jacket and he was gone. I'm like, oh, great. So I'm trying to get dressed to get outside. I don't have a hat, but I've got a jacket with a hood, so I'm good enough. By the time I catch up to him, he's already halfway down the block, and I do catch up to him. He is very upset, being obstinate, and I'm trying just to push to nudge him and just to get him home and say, come on, man, let's get back home. Let's deal with this. Let's work it out. And as I'm doing this, a guy jumps out of his house with what looks like maybe a bow staff or some big piece of lumber. I'm not really sure. Okay, I can't be sure. And begins threatening me to leave my son alone, right? And at the moment, I wasn't thinking, well, isn't it beautiful? We live in a neighborhood where our neighbors are concerned about kids and they're not going to let anything happen to them. No, of course. my thought is, this is none of your business, buddy. Get back in your house, right? This is my son. Which then Zach had to say, yes, this is my dad. Is that your dad, really, boy? You know, whatever. And so, you know, but I there's a fine line. There's a fine line between watching out for your neighbor's kids, keeping an eye on things, being a good citizen and a good neighbor, and intrusion. And when you're calling the cops on your neighbors because they're playing in their backyard, probably that would be one that's probably going a little bit too far. Coming out and threatening fathers with sticks in hand, probably going a little bit too far. I got to think about this kind of stuff. So I saw this earlier today, and honestly, I haven't been able to spend a lot of time with the article, but I get what they're getting at here. Newsweek magazine is basically saying that, or asking, I guess it seems, has the Catholic Church lost its relevancy? And essentially talking about the fact that we are now in a what appears to be, and this has been for some time, a free fall of sorts when it comes to numbers leaving, and that's been there. But they take this back to the priest abuse scandal and say, you know, is there a credibility that was damaged there? Is this something that is beyond repair? I think that there's and they do. They give credence to Pope Francis being in for the past few years, seemingly making strides when it comes to perception of the church. But I guess they're asking, is the Catholic brand? I think it's interesting the way they present this. And I'm not offended by any of this, quite frankly. But I think it's interesting that they're asking, is there something about the brand of Catholicism that is a challenge in and of itself? Have we done some sort of damage that says there's a connotation that is associated with Catholic? And I would pray that that's not the case. I would hope that we have credibility and we could stand on the tradition of who we are and what we are. But to some, it doesn't matter, right? The old adage of, to those who understand, no meaning, no explanation is necessary. To those who don't, no explanation will suffice. That is something that is alive and well in all of this. And we got to realize that that's an unfortunate dynamic that exists, that nothing to some can be done. And to some of those, I know personally, who were raised Catholic, they have grown up in the church, and there was a trigger point at some point that they simply said, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to either find another church to call home, or I am going to find something entirely different. But whatever it is, I'm done with the Catholic Church. We've heard of those. And rarely it's because they just didn't get the kind of education. There was something experiential, right? There was something happened. And I can't say this enough I'll say it every time we talk about things of this nature. Please, because it's important to see these stories, hear these stories, understand them, please read that book, Being Catholic Now, which is now probably, what, 10 or so years old, I'm guessing, at least. And the Kerry Kennedy compilation of very influential individuals with big platforms and lots of attention, Bill Maher, Bill O'Reilly, you name it, a couple of names that immediately come to mind, big name politicians. There's a number of individuals in this. Nancy Pelosi is one, who share their stories of their experience in Catholicism and why they're either engaged or disengaged. And I tell you, some of them that are more disturbing are the ones that are engaged in the perception they have or the perspective they have on their faith is so not in line, right? That's disturbing. I was like, okay, well, you're still embracing this, but why are you embracing it with the understanding you have? My goodness, right? I mean, that's difficult. But I think it's valuable to read this and understand where everyone is, or at least, let's put it this way, where the dozen or so she profiles in this book, where they are, that's a pretty good little cross-section of where everybody else is. And I think so frequently we forget that, and we don't realize that, yeah, there's everybody's at different places on this journey. We can't necessarily assume that because we're at one place that anyone else is there at that particular time or isn't even been there, because we've got so many different experiences that shape and form our perspective. And there are those who've had painful, very painful realities. And it may not necessarily just be because of something egregious occurring. It could have been something innocuous occurring, but because of their reaction, it spun them off course. Bill Maher in this book talking about watching a nun do something to his friend. Not even him. It wasn't even him. It wasn't his experience. He just recounts this nun being very whatever, insulting or degrading or whatever it was in this experience, that he said, I'm done. I don't want that. That's so antithetical to what I want to accept and believe. I refuse to accept and believe it. And it wasn't even him with the actual experience. So I think we've got to have a degree of sensitivity to that. And we can't just simply assume that because we have a degree of appreciation or we have a degree of experience or whatever, that anyone else is thinking that way. So back to this Newsweek article asking, is the Catholic brand damaged? Yes, to many it is. But hopefully we as Catholics, and certainly we as humans and as caring, ideally, and loving individuals, certainly if we were to take the lead of Pope Francis and say, we're the brand now, be the brand, be that which people experience, be that which people see, and regardless of what their prior experiences were, regardless of what they've had to deal with in the past, let this be what is now, right? Let this be what they see. And is there a way that because they see us not just loving each other, but loving them, not just accepting each other, but accepting them, is there a way that by doing that, we can make a difference? Tough, but doable. That's all we have time for this afternoon. Thank you for joining us. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. God bless you.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.